Hey, engine professionals, machinists, and enthusiasts, welcome to the Engine Professional Podcast.
Hey, listeners, welcome back to another edition of the Engine Professional Podcast presented by AERA. My name is Steve Fox. I'm here with my co-host, Chuck Lynch. Chuck, how's it going?
Going well, Steve. I think spring has sprung.
Well, maybe for you, but not up here in old Chicagoland. We had some bad rains the other day, then it was followed up by some snow, and we've had all four seasons in about a week here, so we don't know what we're at.
Yeah, it's a little crazy, but tornado season seems to be upon us, so...
Yeah. It's that time of year. Mm-hmm. So I can't wait to warm weather and get outside and do some things. While staying cooped up in the house over the winter is not fun.
I hear that.
Well, since our last podcast, we've got a new addition to our tech team, and that is Mr. Andy Kennedy, who came from a member shop and has filled the position of Dave Hagen, who retired in June of 23. So Andy actually reached out to Chuck and wanted to come on and be a part of our team. So Chuck, I'll just let you kind of explain Andy a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, quite fitting, actually. Andy has that industrial diesel background that we were looking for with a retirement of Dave. Andy had worked at a couple of custom machine shops that were primary ag industrial. He worked for a production engine rebuilder in the Springfield area that was a diesel-only engine shop. So he's got a good deal of experience there. For the past 14 years, he's worked directly with a place that does tractors, ag, industrial, skid steers, and so forth. So, yeah, that's exactly what we were trying to fill, and I think Andy's going to do a great, great job for us there.
Yeah, he's a good fit for our team. He's very well-versed in that segment of the market, has helped out a lot with our tech guys as far as answering some questions, kind of ag-related or industrial-related. So he'll be a good fit for our team and glad to have him on board.
Yeah. Another positive thing that he's been able to bring from that industry is he knows where to get core parts, pieces, and he's taken a lot of those calls already. Core's a challenge, and he knows where to find that stuff. So that's a super big positive for the folks.
It was great because we went down to the HDAW show and our travels were a little challenging then. The adventures of air travel, trying to get to interview Andy up to his, up in Missouri there, but glad to have him on board. Like I said earlier, he'll be a good fit. And if our members who have talked to him, please welcome him. And if you haven't, please welcome him to our team. And we're just glad to have him to fill that position. It takes a lot of load off of us for some other projects we got to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Small team. We wear a lot of hats. So one person's a big addition.
We wear a lot of hats, that's for sure. So kind of transitioning to another thing, I'd like to announce we finally got a couple dates for our regional conferences. June 7th is going to be down in Piney Flats, Tennessee at the AAM Group Straub Technology Facility. That's going to be a pretty neat one, Chuck. It's going to be more of a roundtable discussion with some of the presentations, and it's going to be a little technical, a little business. That's on Friday, June 7th. On Thursday, June 6th, there's actually going to be a Rottler CWT Machine Day. So if anybody wants to come in who's thinking about buying a Rottler machine or wants to get some training on a Rottler machine or a CWT machine, you have that ability to come in on Thursday. That will be at an additional charge. But I think that's a good thing to try to get guys in that need some help with, just want to get some hands on some machines.
Right. And I think that they've actually been running out of seat capacity for some of the honing classes they've been doing. So this is just another venue to do that at.
Yeah, that'll be good. That's in conjunction with the NHRA Bristol race that happens that weekend. So if anybody is interested in coming down to the race or going to the conference, you want to stay a couple days, you can hit the race Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, you can accomplish some work and pleasure and learning.
So. Absolutely, absolutely. And then our next one is July 27th in Oxnard, California at Vortex Superchargers. That's a new member who joined a couple years ago, and they actually donated the supercharger for the EREF engine. We gave away a PRI, and I'm pretty sure they plan on doing that again this year. So a new facility for them. Super excited to have them on board as a host and looking forward to going out there.
Yeah, that should be really, really good one. I know that last year they were just super helpful, and like I said, we're looking forward to that again this year. Great people in the industry.
Yes, yes. Well, we might as well jump into our topic. One that has come up quite frequently on the tech line, I'd say, over the last, I don't know, 6-8 months, probably longer than that, to be honest with you. But it's parts cleaning. Pretty important to get every part cleaned. And I'll kind of maybe digress off subject here a little bit. But one of the articles that I wrote for this issue, this upcoming issue in EP Magazine, is your teardown guy. So I think these two kind of go hand in hand, Chuck, because your teardown guy usually does more of the parts cleaning in a machine shop, I would say. You agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where your parts guy or your teardown guy is pretty important in the shop, in my opinion, because when he's tearing things down, it's like he's the private eye of your business, where he's dissecting things, looking at things, making notes, and jotting things down. And now that'll lead to the parts cleaning part, which is, like we said, probably one of the most important jobs in the shop that we think. And it's important to process, as you don't want to have any dirt or grime moving through the shop when it comes to machining. You want those parts as clean as possible.
Right. You're just going to exacerbate that issue by having something wet and sticky, and then you put metal chips on it. So, yeah, cleanliness next to godliness. So it's very important that you put those efforts into a clean.
Kind of just thought of something there when you said that. How many times do you think the shops get these? Oh, I just want you to mill that head. Don't clean it. Don't do nothing with it. Just mill it.
Oh, often, yeah. on the tech line, because I've had the conversation and I'm not putting that on my machine.
Yep.
Yep. One, it's not going to do you any good to have all those chips stuck to it, but I got an investment in my equipment here, and I don't want that grease and oil and coolant being sprayed on my mill.
Yeah. A lot of guys will they would bring it to the shop I worked in. We would not, if we didn't clean it, we were not putting it on the machine.
There's good practice.
It just leads to more problems down the road. You think you got all the chips out of there, and like you said, you there's always one that'll hang around and be a thorn in your side.
Right. And again, that's your machine, your equipment, your investment.
Right.
You don't want to mistreat it just to satisfy that guy's, hey, I don't want to spend money for cleaning. Yeah, go to the next guy.
And without a doubt, you're the last one to touch it. So if something happens, it's your fault.
True.
So in the machine shop, there's basically two kinds of materials that need cleaning, I would say, that are common, and that's cast iron and aluminum. And each one kind of requires a different form of cleaning, and we'll kind of discuss those different types as we start moving throughout the podcast here. What are some of the most important things or challenges that our shops face, Chuck, when it comes to cleaning?
Well, I guess if we want to start out with cast iron, so cast iron, you can be more aggressive with it, right? You can use stronger chemicals, you can do heat, things of that nature. But when cleaning cast iron, you can do things like steel abrade or steel shot blast or whatever. So if you're a real concern that you would have there would be trap shot impingement and carrying that through to your assembly, right? You can use hot tank with caustic chemical. Is that what you used in your shop?
We used both. We had caustic chemicals and we had thermal cleaning.
Okay.
Yeah, we did both.
Yeah, yeah. So caustic chemical, I think, you know, chemicals everywhere is getting tougher, right? But that's still the very accepted thermal cleaning. It's been around for a long time, works well. Again, you got to worry about shot impingement and so forth. It's, you know, with thermal cleaning, again, it's just that there are fewer and fewer things that you want to put in there now. So it probably doesn't have the popularity that it once had for that reason, you know, because we have such a mix of materials coming through. I came from an environment where for a period of time we used a coaling system. It was salt bath and you heated to 730 degrees. You should dip the iron products in it. It's extremely fast, but it's almost phased itself out because you can't run steel in it. You don't want to put your powdered metal connecting rods in it. You cannot put aluminum in it. Every seat and guide would fall out. So anyway, those are things you definitely have to consider. So that's actually a part of like the salt bath processing, that you would do for nitriding, tuftriding, melaniting. You've heard of those terms, you know, used on crankshafts and engine valves and so forth. Again, it was a very expedient process, but it's kind of phased itself out. I know Caterpillar still uses it for big giant blocks and whatnot. But again, it's not really something that we're going to see be used in the aftermarket too much now.
No, I'm glad you touched on that because as we were making notes, excuse me, I was kind of, when I read that, I was like, ooh, I've never heard that before. So it was kind of neat to have you explain that and kind of go over what that salt bath thermal cleaning is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, where we would take from the salt bath and then would go into what you do is you dip it in a tank of water and it shocks the salt out of it. And then you go to an acid rinse and then an alkaline rinse. When you do nitriding, they go into ammonia baths and so forth. So again, it's a process that's still used for different processing. But yeah, we stole part of that process to clean with. So pretty interesting.
How did you guys come about that? Do you know where that came from? Where you guys started? What industry was that? It was it in our industry or was it in a different industry?
I think that because it was in a different industry, that Coaling recognized that, hey, they could market this to mass engine rebuilders. Now, again, it was something you're not going to do this for a small shop.
No.
The system was probably 10,000 square feet.
Oh,
maybe
wow.
More.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you...
In a production style shop, that'd be...
Right, right. Yeah. Big hoist systems, you know, huge amount of gas supplied to it. So, you know, like you have a, you know, several hundred gallon vats of salt that's molten, the safety requirements, the exhaust ventilation requirements and so forth. So pretty interesting. I'll tell another little story about it that's kind of pretty scary, though. You had to be really, really cognizant of how well the blocks were cleaned out as far as coolant in the water passages. Because if you take water from ambient 80 degrees to 730 degrees, what happens? Like immediately, it goes from liquid to gas really, really, really fast, right? So that's expansion. So we had some quite big kabooms on occasion, and it would blow a cylinder block to pieces. I mean, wow. Chiclets. So the safety things that go with it too. But anyway, again, that's not, it's just a, you know, interesting little bit of information. Doesn't help a whole lot of people, but the stuff's out there now. Again, if you're doing 3,500 cats or something, you're probably familiar with it.
Not doing a onesie block through there. You're doing multiple blocks through there.
Right, right.
Well, that brings us to like a hot tank with caustic chemicals. And then I would say most guys, well, I don't know that anymore. I've been so long since I've been out of the shop, but chemical, powder? What's better? What's the big differences between the two?
So I asked this question of a company. They do a lot of presentations for like the PRA conferences and stuff. And I asked them one time, I'm like, so, you know, if you start with powder versus, you know, a liquid, what's the difference? And they're like, well, it's more about convenience because everything started from a powder and we pre-mix it. Now, the downside is weight, right? If you get to liquid and it's shipped to you, that's heavy.
Mm-hmm.
But the concentration's easier to manage because it's already a liquid. So you think of it, you go to a restaurant, you order tea, but you want to put the sweeteners in there yourself. So you get unsweetened tea, and then they bring you the sweeteners, and they sink to the bottom, and you have a hard time getting stirred up. So that's kind of a product of, okay, they have it pre-mixed. It's already in a solid. It's a liquid. It's been through that processing. So it works much better for you that you're not having just the stuff settle out in the bottle of your tank. But again, this guy, you know, from Madison Chemical, he said, man, they all started as a powder, your soaps and things of that nature. It's just that we've done the processing that makes life easier for you, so you're not fighting it and dealing with the agitation as much. So right. I thought that was pretty interesting. I'm like, you know, yeah, chemically wise, I guess they are the same. It's just the preparation.
Yeah, so it's really what you can get.
Right.
If you can pick it up, I'd probably take the liquid, per se, you know, but then you got to deal with dumping it in and all that other stuff. But
mm-hmm.
I think when we did it, we did powder. We did mostly powder.
Yeah, and with shipping costs today,
oof.
You really got to consider that. I'm having somebody ship me mostly water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I got a bunch of that here already. And without a doubt, sometimes our members or machine shops, they'll get something in that is super dirty, greasy, grimy. They may not have a thermal type cleaning. Back in the day before we had thermal, we decided to soak them a lot of times, try to get some of that stuff off in the bottom. We had a cabinet out in the front of our hot tank where we would just soak stuff overnight. Still a common practice, you think?
It is. You know, and there's been changes in some chemicals out there that even work cold. So you just soak cold. You don't have to have the heat. And that's been a good thing to do. Now, if you are using, you know, like a heated caustic tank, I know, been there, done that. Oh, man, it's just, it needs some soak time. Let's leave this thing overnight or something. Mm-hmm. And you have a pretty aggressive setup, you know, heat-wise, and your caustic is strong. And then you come in and your iron looks like a sponge. So, you know, you just have to think of those things. What is going to happen if I extend this by
right.
2 times, 10 times, you know? So just depending on your chemicals, you know, if you're using Totally Awesome, that stuff you buy at the Dollar General store, a lot of people soak parts in that. I think you're probably going to be okay to have some extended soak times. But just think about your chemical. Think about your part that you're putting in there. You know, how valuable is it? Because, you know, you don't want to forget about it and come back with a sponge and then yeah. Now you're buying a guy a block or something.
Yeah, and I think a couple times or multiple times, really, we would probably just wash it multiple times throughout the we ran it through the system. If it didn't look clean enough, we just run it again and see what happens. You know, it's mm-hmm. one of those things. So definitely, if you'd rather not soak it, multiple wash cycles are good as well.
Right.
Now, using those hot tanks, you know, obviously you got all that dirt and grime. How often should those be clean or dumped? You got any insight on those?
You know, we take that call and it's a real challenge because it's usage, right? It's usage dependent. I just had this conversation with somebody on the phone just yesterday. Well, if you're a shop and you run your stuff 24/7, that it's got parts and pieces in it. You know, I do soak overnight. Shop's close to where I'm at. So I go in after hours and move things. Then, you know, the chemical company, they want to sell you chemicals. Right. Oh, yeah, you ought to dump that every 2 weeks. Well, you got guys that do 50 blocks in 2 weeks and you got guys that do 5 blocks in 2 weeks. Should they be dumped on the same interval? Doesn't make sense. I think each shop has to really look at their usage rate and determine it by that. Yeah, that's not a good answer that is easy, though. But I think that's what you have to do, is understand your productivity, how much stuff you're processing. There are things like titration kits and so forth that says, okay, the chemical's still strong, but it's just loaded with dirt, you know, and things that, so is it maybe filtration? And when, sometimes when you have aggressive chemicals, you have to have pretty unique filters, right? Or else, hey, my chemical ate my filter.
Where's my filter at? I thought I put one in there. how to dispose of that stuff? That is probably one of the most common questions we get when it comes to hot tanks and cleaning, is what do I do with that chemical to dispose of it properly?
Yeah, this is another one. It's a challenge for us on the tech line, right? So right. What do we do? We're like, okay, the United States is a big country. We have states that are bigger than a lot of countries. And the states vary. So we're probably going to give you the answer you need to check with local officials.
Yep.
Because if we say, you know, hey, you can take it to such and such. Hey, I'm in Oregon. We don't even have a such and such.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, one of the things that's going to be talked about it at the tech and skills down in Piney Flats is some of that cleaning stuff. And so one of the ones that was mentioned was Safety Clean, and we know they're coast to coast. Somebody like that, maybe you call them and have some discussion with them. But I think there's definitely agencies within your state. You don't probably want to call OSHA. It just invites them to start looking. But, you know, there, you might talk to voluntary protection programs and things of that nature to just help you out, because that's the real challenge. And that's what we have to tell people on the tech line, because we just don't know. There's 50 states, there may be 100 different rules.
Correct. You'll get 50 different answers depending on who you ask. But that, you do bring up a good point with like Safety Clean. Probably just checking with whoever does your minerals, mineral solvents and stuff like that. If you swap those out on a monthly or bi-monthly basis or whatever, check with them and see what they can do to try to, maybe they'll do some of that stuff and you don't even know it. But definitely check with those guys to see if they can help you out.
Yeah. Ask. Why?
Ask. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Advantages, disadvantages of hot tank cleaning. I think we've kind of ran over a couple of them here, but maybe just kind of go over the pros and cons of those.
Yeah, probably the biggest con for us, right, is the maintenance of it.
Talked about.
Exactly. where do I take it? What do I do? How do I deal with the filtration? The pros of it, most anyone can have that system. Utilities to operate are not too special, like some of the ovens and other machines. Other industries as well have the equipment. So, like we had talked about the coaling, did it come from this industry? Was it for this industry or was it another industry? There are so many industries that are using caustic tanks to clean stuff, you know, from pipes that are rusty and so forth. So it's well supported. So that's probably something you want to consider too in any part you're cleaning. Hey, if another industry is doing this, then I probably got good support. If it's a really boutique kind of thing, I might be struggling for support.
Right, right. And that you can use those hot tanks not just for cast iron. I mean, I know some guys probably dedicate one for aluminum cleaning, one for cast iron cleaning.
Right.
Your chemicals will be different.
Yeah, your chemicals are going to be different. So I guess that's kind of where you really, you know, hot tank doesn't mean caustic soda.
Correct.
So.
Which brings us to the aluminum section. We'll talk about cleaning all that stuff up. And what are some of our options for that? Like I think we just talked about the hot tank with an aluminum type cleaner in it.
Yeah, so soaking of the aluminum is a good place to start. Aluminum is a challenge. It is just, I did an article And I said that the issue is elemental, not elementary, elemental. Aluminum gives you challenges because I can't be aggressive with my chemical or temperature. So again, hot tank doesn't mean that it's caustic soda. So you can use some chemicals that are out there and soak the aluminum safely, break the stuff down, but we've not found anything that there's no magic wand in a bottle that you can just throw aluminum in and it's going to come out clean. You know, percentage wise, you and I had this conversation. How much of the parts that we're seeing now are aluminum come through the door?
Way more than there used to be. Probably 75-80% nowadays.
Yeah. So we think cylinder heads, yeah, they've been aluminum for a long time. But now it's your cylinder head, your block. It's your timing cover, your oil pan.
Yep.
Your valve cover. You're getting all of this stuff. And it's a huge amount of it. So that's going to increase your load that goes into the to your tanks because that high percentage is aluminum. It's, yeah, it's not getting easier. You had mentioned, you know, that oftentimes like a powdered metal connecting rod, you probably want to clean it something more like you would your aluminum too. So that works pretty well in that area. You don't want to get anything that's so aggressive that starts to mess with that fractured cap interface. It's pretty easy to get stuff kind of embedded in that, or if you have a chemical that's fairly aggressive and it changes that to a, you know, those all those little fractures are like a fingerprint.
Right.
So if it etches some of that away, so it's probably good to clean that like you would your aluminum too. So there again, not aggressive a chemical, so it might take more time to soak and clean.
Several different medias that can be used, and they've kind of evolved over the last couple of years maybe, but there's many different ways to clean aluminum.
Right. So ultrasonics, you know, or well, soaking.
Yep.
To get it prepped initially. But as I said, there's usually going to be some touching afterwards. And, you know, baking soda, we've been hearing people using baking soda for 30 plus years or whatever in cleaning. There's a lot of medias out there. Baking soda, it's not real aggressive. So if you have stuff that, like cylinder heads and exhaust ports that are, or intake ports even, you know, they're get sludged up or in there in bad areas, they don't soak out real well. Then, you know, there's stuff like plastic, which, you know, I came from navigating to that. We used to use a lot of Black Beauty and sand. We use glass. And once we went to plastic, ooh, man, this is a lot safer than, you know, than having glass that's kind of opaque and you don't see it. Walnut hulls. Actually, there's a few different companies out there that have multimedia machines. And something that's been recent is like bentonite clay, which is used for all kinds of stuff from well drilling. It's actually in some of the silicones. I use that silicone RTV, you know, the form in place gasketing stuff, and it gives it density. But the bentonite clay, they actually make like little balls of this stuff look like BBs, and it has a lot of energy when they blast. So you can use that. It's just crazy. You can get pretty creative when it comes to the blasting operation. But aluminum, you know, you got to soak, you got to blast, you got to buff. I know when I worked on that article, I went to Jasper and we took pictures and of the, you know, the maintenance systems that they have. And I know they've been working with dual media blasting, and even they're going to advance that further with some really modern technology and blast equipment, you know, that has vision system and whatnot. So, That's been something that's maybe helpful, because a guy standing in front of one of those cabinets looking through that hole blasting parts for hours and hours on end, you know, that's one of the things they want to get rid of. Right. You know, you think standing there watching a crank spin and a grinder, that's nothing compared to looking through a window in a blast cabinet, right?
Exactly. Oh, shoot. Speaking of chemicals, again, like we had mentioned earlier, similar to the cast iron cleaning, changing those chemicals either in a hot tank or ultrasonic cleaner, how often should that be? Does that last longer? Maybe because it's not as dirty compared to cast iron?
I don't think that we can say that at all. I think what we should say is with the less aggressive chemicals, it does lend itself to filtration. So you can probably save some money. But the thing is, and we hear this all the time with ultrasonics, it worked great for a couple weeks. If you think about how that works, I have these generators that create these little bubbles. And inside of that bubble, you've created a vacuum because you created that bubble under a solution. As it travels through the solution and hits the parts, you have an implosion. It's just like cavitation erosion that you would have inside of the engine that tears diesels up, that eats through the cylinders. Same process is going on. So that little implosion hits the part, it explodes, and it picks away at the debris. It's kind of like effort in cleaning dentures. Fortunately, I'm not at that point now, but maybe someday I'll have to use effort in. But anyway, that's how it functions. Well, if you think about the load, okay, I've been for 2 weeks, I've been picking that stuff off, and now it's in my suspension. So my little bubble that I generate hit something along the way. I hit space junk. I implode before I ever get to the part I'm trying to clean. This doesn't work as well as it did. You need to maintain your ultrasonic ultrasonic machines daily. And that's one of the things that, like in that article that I had taken some pictures of, was the systems that filter out the crap that's in suspension. That's what you have to do with ultrasonics, and it would be very effective. If you do not maintain it daily, then it's not going to perform for you. You might as well just have a hot soap tank. It's really, really good method of cleaning. I mean, the stuff works great, but again, people just don't want to maintain it on a daily basis. And again, what you could do, they actually had some filters. You know, everybody's seen the little wheel that picks up the debris out of the solution. They have the thing, it looked like a crankshaft polishing belt. And so it's a lot more surface area, and it picks up, it works kind of like a conveyor, and it carries the trash out, it goes to a bucket, and every single day, those things are running after the shift. So it worked really, really well. I'd recommend something like that. Again, and then you can put the inline filtration where, you know, they have a pump and it turns that tank over really, really fast. So a good quality filter. So you spend the money there so you can save it on your chemical. And then you can do titration kits that said, hey, my chemical is still at this strength level. Because most of the time, I think we're throwing away good chemical that's just full of dirt. So we need to look at, you know, is it truly bad chemical, or is it just the dirt load? And manage those two differently. I think a lot of times we're like, oh, you know, it's kind of like throwing out the baby with the water. You know, use that old analogy. So anyway, we don't want to throw out the baby with the water. We just right. want to get the trash out of the water. So.
Right. Kind of backing up, you had mentioned that article. Just so our listeners know, your viewers, you can go to our website, aera.org. You can search Engine Professional, and you'll find this website there. I believe it's engineprofessional.com. You can search. There's a search box up there to search for cleaning, and you'll be able to find Chuck's article where you can reference some of the things he's mentioned throughout the podcast here.
Yeah, so that word search function works great. You can simply type ultrasonic and you'll find every ultrasonic article that's been mentioned. You can search by author, but you know, most of us, we don't know who maybe did that article years ago.
Right.
But we can think, hey, spray weld. It works really, really well. So just go to archives, and then you're going to see a little magnifying glass, word search anything that you want.
And our members that use the Process Pro software, we actually have a tab up at the top of the page for engine articles. You can find some information in there as well on all the articles that, well, not all the articles, but some of the articles that we've put into the program just for easy access. Back to our topic here, Chuck. Cleaning aluminum thermally, can it be done? I'm sure there's a lot of precautions. You better pay attention if you do decide to do that.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's funny that years ago, those were test questions for certifications, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you're going to clean aluminum, how long can it be? You know, it's time temperature thing. Well, you can heat it to 250, but you better not do it for more than 4 hours or you'll anneal the aluminum. And so I think a lot of people were like, they've just hexed it. Hey, I don't want to even mess with trying to clean my aluminum thermally. Seats and guides falling out, as I mentioned earlier, with the coaling system, except that happened instantly. That was a good way to, hey, if I want to clean everything out of this, I'll just do that. And then you find, well, it just ruined the aluminum. Now it's soft, you know, so that, I use the analogy multiple times because it's relevant in a lot of places. If I blow a head gasket and warp a head really bad, I may have killed my rings too. The same heat that hardens the egg softens the potato. And that's what you have this situation here. So T6 treatment of your aluminum is a heat treat process. But I could have a cleaning process that is not managed properly for trying to heat treat something and I soften it. So that's another kind of downside to thermal cleaning of aluminum. One of the other issues with thermal cleaning, you know, we think about the cylinder head, but if you're thermal cleaning, for instance, a timing cover, rear seal housing, so you have a larger amount of mass in part of that, and then there's usually a little hoop that goes down close to the oil pan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll see is that big area of mass will absorb the heat, and it runs to thin areas, right? Anybody's ever taken a piece of sheet metal and put a torch to it, the corners get really hot. Heat moves to thin areas. So what happens when you got a seal housing is that little saddle will get knocked out around really, really bad because of the difference in mass material. So, you know, you're fighting seal leaks and you keep looking at the seal, you look at your surface finish of the shaft and well, if I have a hole that's an egg that I'm putting the seal in, then now my seal is an egg, or it may be leaking around the outside diameter of the seal. So cause and effect. So sometimes you're not even looking where your leak is at. So that was a learned issue from using thermal cleaning for front and rear seal housings, timing covers. So that's a downside. Again, the aluminum, you know, you just don't want to have cam bores knocked out around. You don't want the seats and guides falling out. You don't want the thing annealed.
I think we've touched on a lot here with cleaning, and I think, in my opinion, this part of the journey of the engine through the shop is just as important, and one of the biggest struggles that our members have in the shop is the cleaning part of it. Maybe more so than machining, but I would definitely say cleaning is right up there.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and sometimes this offends people, but I've said it for a lot of years. That's such a super important area. You should actually try to promote the inspection and cleaning and casting repair and stuff, as those are your most talented folks.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people, you know, and I said this at one of the engine performance expos things. If you go to Walmart and you buy a bookcase and you take it out of that big cardboard box and you follow the instructions and you get this bookcase assembled, it doesn't make you a cabinet maker because you don't know what it, you know, right, the math to get there. You don't know what it takes to make a cabinet. You're a screw turner, a bolt turner. And we have engine assemblers, you know, Summit's made their living doing this for a lot of years, is selling stuff that should go together. So you can bolt stuff together and not understand that the fire ring of the head gasket shouldn't hang into the bore, that torque plus angle, torque to yield, don't necessarily mean torque. You know, it's about the bolt stretch and so. So you need to know a lot more things about how an engine functions, because you don't really have to know that to bolt an engine together. But a guy who can be doing teardown and cleaning and inspection is, you know, as you said earlier, you know, he's that scientist. He's, you know,
that private eye guy.
Private eye guy. Yeah. And that is so important. And I think we struggle to get people to understand that. And I definitely came from that environment, you know, ooh, that guy up there assembling the engine doesn't get his 30 and so forth. Yep. So, you know, there's a little bit of that prima donna thing that the guy putting them together, he kind of feels, because, you know, that's who people, you know, in the racing world, ooh, the engine builder. Well, he truly is an engine builder. It's a different deal. So true engine builders, they earn that, but they probably know the disassembly stuff back there too, and the inspection, the private eye type stuff. But I think there's a lot of good that comes with dirty hands.
Oh, yes. Know? It's kind of like I referenced in the article there. It's like, that's the crime scene, if you want to call it that. You know, mm-hmm. When that engine comes in, that's the crime scene, and this gentleman or individual has to tear it apart, make all these notes, and kind of investigate what happened, or why is this engine here as a failure, this, that, or the other, and make sure that doesn't happen down the road. But again, that's the guy that's doing all the parts cleaning and making sure things are put cleaned the way they should be.
Yeah, because without him making good decisions, you know, you might be doomed to repeat it, you know, if you don't address the issue. I got a crack in a crankshaft or something like that, I'm going to have another failure.
Correct. Well, Chuck, I think hopefully we didn't muddy the waters with on the cleaning part of things here, but I think we gave some good insight on cleaning. Again, if you guys have any questions about the podcast, about this episode, you can reach us at eppodcast@aera.org. We'll be happy to answer any questions, or if you have a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to talk about, feel free to send it. We have a list, but we're always looking for more topics and more information to talk about. So moving on, if you can also sign up for our podcast if you're not through your podcast listening platforms, or you can visit engineprofessionalpodcast.com and you can sign up there or listen to any past podcast. Chuck, anything else as we sign off here?
No, I think that kind of covers it. I think that we're everywhere.
We so are everywhere.
Yeah. Whatever your favorite media is, we're out there. So love to see you listening.
All right, Chuck. Well, if nothing else, we'll, as we say, get back to the puzzle factory. See ya. Thank you.